And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from the Philadelphia Sixers practice facility in lovely Camden, New Jersey, where I am in the office of and joined by the head coach of the 76ers, Brett Brown. How you doing?
Doing great, Zach. Thanks for having me.
You're always doing great. I admire people who have this such positivity.
You know, it's the life that we've lived here in Philadelphia to look back and have the opportunity to come in here and, you know, have a chance to sort of rebuild a program and have it sort of be where it has ended up, where you really have a chance to do something special, I believe. Along that journey, there's been many reasons at times to not sleep at night, but by and large, life is good.
Yeah, no kidding. Would you like to have a normal coaching job for like two consecutive weeks? Have you had two consecutive weeks of normalcy in Philadelphia? No, the answer I think is no.
And I think it's a loud, quick no. And and whether you, I mean, think about it. Think about sort of, you know, the history of our general managers. You know, from Sam to Brian, I was a fake one for about 3 months. Now we have a former player of mine, an Elton Brand. You know, think about the draft picks from Jaleel to Rookie of the Year, Michael Carter Williams, to, you know, two season out, Navicula Joel, to a season out, Ben Simmons, to, you know, the situation with Markel Fultz. It has been completely, and it's all under the roof of Philadelphia. So, like, it gets looked at. It's been a very atypical sort of six-year coaching career here.
You literally could not make it up. You could not make just the Colangelo and Markel parts alone. You just couldn't. It would be too ridiculous for a movie.
And so, you know, for me, because I think they count I do almost 400 and something interviews a year, you know, from stuff like this to pregame to postgame to shoot arounds to all that. And you try to string a thread through just being truthful and still protective, because it's not everybody's privilege to know the true ins and outs of everything. And so to be able to be, you know, transparent and candid and honest and still protect programs and people, that's a slippery slope. And me sort of as the primary microphone holder, you know, you take that responsibility seriously. And so living that world, we just, you know, kind of mapped out quick, and we didn't even mention the 10-game season. Is
the 10-win season.
Yeah, 10-win season. I see in my mind I've tried to, but then, like, just change the verbiage.
How far are you under 500 for your career right now?
Is it?
Can you get over? How many years of, like, winning 60 games is it going to take?
It's funny. I honestly don't even know or pay attention, and I feel some of that is a strength, where I feel comfortable, you know, just living sort of in whatever season or period of the season or whatever quite well and putting things in perspective. But to your point, I would assume it's a lot. I do not know the true numbers.
It's honestly, if you look at the career record of head coaches who have been in the league a long time, if you get up to like a 530 winning percentage, like, it doesn't have to be super, not you personally, like, if you have a career record of like 530, you're like top 30 all time NBA head coaches. Like, if you stick around for a long time. So right. I'm just saying, okay. We have established that you've had a strange tenure in Philadelphia. This is a strange team in the sense that it's, after the Tobias and Jimmy trades, which are now 4 months old for Jimmy and like a month for Tobias, you have a brand new team again.
Yeah.
And you've talked frequently about how you've had three different versions of just this season's team. The team you have now is huge. It has been injured, so we've barely gotten to see it. You're starting five. Apologies to Tim Bontemps. Fantastic Five with a PH is a horrible nickname. We need to do better than that. Has played only 83 minutes together. So when I watch you guys of late, I've been checking my own impulse to be like, something doesn't feel right. I feel uneasy. I feel like they haven't landed on an identity. Because then you remember, Joel's missing 8 games, and he's, I can say it, maybe you can, he's the best player on the team. And then other guys have been in it, like Butler didn't play there. And I think we've barely seen the team. So I have to check my own uneasiness. Like, they need some time. That said, we are running out of time before the playoffs. So do you feel uneasy?
I don't feel, how do I phrase this? I'm aware. I'm acutely aware of what I think needs to be done. The vision line that I have, the privileged vision line that I have of seeing a bunch of championships and what it really takes to play in May and June lets me say this, I think, with more of a context. We're not even close to the detail of where we would need to be. And so my version of the world as it sits on March, whatever it is, you know, middle of March, is I got to land the plane. I got to keep the people in the boat. You need a spirit. You need to keep people healthy. And to your point, whatever is perfect vanilla as far as simplicity goes and accountability, so that you take the newness of a team and just master simple. That's my goal. When you get into the intricacies of like situation basketball and, you know, down three, you know, catch shot offense, whatever, it's some of that you're going to need some legwork and some experience mastering. And I think that as it sits, no is the blatant truthful answer. But I do feel like if we can have, we got 14 games and then hit the ground running, retain, maintain health and spirit. I like the way that the current of the playoff drags you. You just get caught into a rhythm and, you know, playing basketball. And so I hope with some of those things, we will have enough time to pull this off.
No, it's interesting. The way you talk about a team, particularly the last 2 years of you guys have been good, you've graduated from process to good. He's always interested me because you can talk X's and O's. I mean, you could mark up on this whiteboard all the different ways Joel has guarded the pick and roll and this, that, and the other thing. But you often talk in your interviews about like sort of an amorphous spirit and culture. And culture is like a Spurs word that has permeated the whole league, but like spirit and a feel and an environment in a way that when I listen to you talk, I think he's trying to articulate something. Maybe he doesn't want to get into the very specifics of what he means, or maybe it's hard for him to, maybe it's hard to even nail down what the specifics are. But you know what I'm talking, like, what do you mean when you talk like that? What are you searching for in a team?
I think that when it's 92-92 and you look up the clock and there's a minute 50 left, that it goes to a different place outside of exclusively execution. I think that when people look down the bench and when people look on a court and somebody's shooting a free throw, and you can like look across at somebody and have some level of trust and symmetry, that matters. I've seen it. And it's not about clicking your heels and rolling out talent always. It isn't. And it especially rears its head in the pressure moments. And I choose 92-92, 150 left, game 7, game 6, 5, whatever. You're on the road. Closeout games, pick them. They're coming. And I have lived it. I have coached it before. And it's sort of, you know, missed in regards to how you can quantify it and say it and admit you got it or you don't. It's a vibe. It's a feeling. And I think that it starts with respect from player to player. They don't have to have pizza with each other. They don't got to be hanging out at night with each other. But there is inherent respect earned through a bunch of different examples that add up and accumulate over the course of a year. And so when you just sort of push a team together, albeit talented, and this is, we call it version 3 of the 76ers, some of that stuff you hope happens organically, but it's certainly not happening because the calendar allowed it. The time was not invested, not through anybody's fault, just by fact. And so the spirit of a team matters for some of those reasons.
Listeners, if you didn't already know, and I don't blame you, I'm out of touch, the NBA is wild, wild, and Hulu has all the action. They've even partnered with guys like Joel Embiid and Damian Lillard, fringe MVP candidates, who are doing some pretty wild things for Hulu that you just have to check out. Now that Hulu has live sports, I wouldn't blame anybody for getting on board. If you've been late to Hulu, now's the time. A bunch of people are ditching their cable, and who can blame them when you can watch all the live games you want on Hulu Plus Live TV? It has the same channels as cable. For all you fogies like me, the same channels that you know, for only $45 Watch your favorite teams and the biggest games all season long on Hulu Plus Live TV. Again, no cable required.
Obviously, there's just constant noise about the relationship between Ben and Joel. I've never really written about it because to me it's just speculation. I don't know those guys. I haven't asked them about it. You see it every day. Are they friendly? Is there tension? If there is tension, is it just stemming from the sort of natural push and pull of what pace you play and who controls the offense? Like, how would you characterize their relationship?
Incredibly, at this stage, overrated as it relates to a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if we all, and we have, Ben, Joel, and I have sat in this office that you and I are sitting in right now, probably too many times in their eyes. You know, like it's almost being sort of sequestered to the principal's office and, you know, stuff like that. But over time, you know, the messaging hasn't pivoted. And the history that I personally have with Ben and his family, the longevity that I have had with Joel being the longest serving Philadelphia 76ers since we've all been together, enables me to talk to those two as candidly could be. And the reality that they need each other, that this is their city, this is their program. You're going to be teammates, I hope, for a very, very long time. And at some point, that admission needs to rule the day. In the meantime, as I just said to you, Zach, like, you don't have to go have pizza with each other every single night or, you know, hang out with each other. That's not it. It's what goes on between the lines. It's respect. It always ends up respect. And what I have seen is the emerging partnership, relationship, respect between the two. And I think if they were pick whatever grade you want to give them, they are completely moving up the food chain. They start to understand. And I think like with the evolving door we've had this year, it's really sort of expedited organically them looking at each other and like, you know, here we still are. Cub's not here and Dario's not here. And, you know, we just got Jimmy Butler and here comes Tobias. And, you know, what's coach going to do with play calls and what are we going to do? I think all that stuff organically has even forged a stronger bond.
Were there bad times? Were there times where you felt it was getting to a point where you were worried?
It was never at that stage. You know, their games are so unique, and Ben's especially, you know, a 6'10 point guard that, you know, and it's still going on where people really don't pick up quickly or defend hard. You know, they're sagging off. They're in Joel's lap. How do I space Ben? How do we let Ben, you know, show his strengths and gifts? He's arguably the fastest guard in the NBA. A lot of times he outruns the offense. You know, does it leave Joel in the dust? You know, growing those two in a partnership way was the starting point because initially, you know, it's not like the games entirely complemented each other's. And so that is real, like, and that is growing. And I think to both of their credit, like, to see those guys fly across the floor and, you know, fist bump, hip bump, like they did the other night. For me, a day ago to look out, 2 days ago to look out and see Joel rebounding for Ben. You know, it's just they're young. People forget that. We're all trying to grow sort of a program under Philadelphia's pressures and expectations. And I'm just so proud of them where they were, which was never terrible, but not great.
Right.
And not because of anything else, for some of the reasons I just said, to a place now where they completely get it. Like they're gonna be teammates for a long time. This is their program and this is their city.
The other thing you hear sometimes about Ben from people who scouted him in college and people who watch him and, you know, the people whose job it is on other teams to get intel and this and that is so we all know Ben doesn't shoot jump shots. He started a little bit lately, right? The question you hear is, does he care enough? Does he have the work habits to do it? There's skepticism from some people that he has the work habits to do it, that he has the dog in him or whatever. What does he?
Let the skeptics be aware, because you can see the office that I have.
Looking at the court right now.
We're looking at the court. So I have beachfront property looking at a beautiful two-court, you know, three-year-old kind of brand-new stadium, and I see what goes on all the time. And, you know, we're all in here early. At times you leave late. and Ben Simmons has invested time. You don't go through what he went through in the playoffs and had to deal with, you know, the way the Celtics defended him, or some people throughout the course of the year would try to foul him and put him to the free throw line without a level of concern. You know, he's prideful. He's always had success. And for the first time, you know, under a very large sort of microscope and audience, you know, somebody game planned and we had seen it, and it was just in a profile environment. And so, like, that's his last memory going into the summer. And to see what he has done and the time that he has put in on his shot, on his free throw, it's going to happen. And if anybody ever gets bored, you know, and really wants to come to an NBA game an hour early, go watch him shoot. Watch the quantity of shots that go in.
I'll watch tomorrow. I'm good.
Look at it. You know, it's real. And you forget what I'm saying. Just sort of bring your calculator and count them. And I think that, like, for instance, since the All-Star break, I think he's 71% from the free throw line. You know, in general, like, it hasn't been the greatest of year accumulation-wise, but it's trending in the way that we want. And so I think his work ethic is unfair. I see him completely putting in the time.
So now that you have this team of huge players at every position, except for JJ, who's a normal shooting guard with the T-Rex wingspan. Sorry, JJ. The most interesting subplot of every – watching a Sixers game is unlike watching any other team in the league. There are so many cross matches and weird matchups. And step one is, okay, who is the other team's point guard defending? And we can talk about the other side of it too. But who is the other team's point guard defending? So the game that sticks out in my mind that's recent was Portland. They came in and they had Dame on Jimmy Butler. And CJ was on Redick, I think. And you have said to me before, you do not want to be a waiter. You do not want to be sitting there and calling plays and saying, pass it there, pass it there. But when you got all five out together, I think just by the nature of who they are as players, Jimmy and Tobias start at the side. They start in the corners. They start on the wings. And Ben and Joel control the ball. And I don't think it's a secret that Jimmy has sometimes struggled with not getting to do as much stuff as he would want. And I watched that game and I was like, that's an opportunity to post up Jimmy, who's a decent post player, against a point guard. And I wonder if you, and that just gets at the tension of, like, you want to play fast sometimes, you want to play in a flow sometimes, but sometimes you have the mismatch hunting. And I have seen some more post ups for Jimmy lately when that matchup materializes. That I assume is on purpose, right?
It is. And your point is true. And although, like, you don't want to, like, oh, you know, slow it up every time and, like, call a play and just try to force a mismatch, there is a large portion of playoff games, especially, you know, in the last period of playoff games, where you have to do that. And we do that, you know, and at times we will need to do it more. I think because of the flow on which we play, and especially our half-court offense, which is an open post, anytime they want, they can fly into the rim and we can look at post targets, you know, mismatches. And so growing, like, Tobias to do that, Mike Scott sometimes gets a smaller guy. Most times the point guard guards JJ.
Right.
But to your point, you know, there'll be times that they don't. Well, or they get cross-matched.
Yeah,
you know, transition.
In the chaos of your game and the chaos that Ben creates in terms of who guards him Ben guards, there'll be 20 possessions a game where their point guard is on a guy they don't want their point guard on.
Yes. And in this environment especially, I think that we, led by me, have to get better. It's a little bit of the worry that I have with, is there time? You know, the familiarity of that environment that you're talking about, and now go at it and punish that mismatch because, you know, somebody small is on Tobias is real. And so my motive, my notion, my approach is to, you know, put it on the players and the team a lot. Like in early offenses, this game's chugging along and we don't score because Ben hasn't scored in the first 3 to 5 seconds of a shot clock. And you feel something. You guys, all day long, you get the right to go to a post and traffic cop and get somebody the ball. And let's play out of it. If it's static, I feel like that's more on me. As you know, you and I spoke before, I see the sport being sort of a third just transition after misses, a third after makes, and a third what I call special teams after free throw, side out of bounds, underneath out of bounds, ATOs. You know, that's a third of our sport. And so, like, to try to probably dig into that third of it where it's more static hoops and go up mismatches interests me as much as the other environment that we talked about.
Has there been the Jimmy film session was the most well-publicized film session of all time, just like the Jimmy practice in Minnesota was the most well-publicized practice. Has there been a second Jimmy moment of tension or yelling or whatever?
No, no. And if there were, I wouldn't tell you.
So I'm not sure if those answers contradict
each
other. Yeah,
no,
Coach.
And that's all right. So you can figure that out. But what I will tell you is this, that the first meeting was, I think, unfair to him. It was highly overrated. It was instigated by me. You know, we do this. What do you think? And, like, he voiced some opinions and some other players talked. It was great. That's my enjoyment of coaching. The candid conversation with players. It's always about relationships and competition to me. And so I think that's part of a team. And that particular situation happened. To your point, you know, it was got a lot of attention. I hope that I just didn't give it new life. It doesn't deserve
No, I don't think you did.
Yeah.
I wish you did, but I don't think you did.
No, no.
But it's been, my point is there hasn't been a second one of those.
No, there hasn't. And, you know, I feel like he's come in and trying to, you know, figure out our style and us figure out him and how do we help and all of that. And at times it's not perfect, but, I think the underlying motive is sincere.
Listeners, you know that getting tickets to sporting events for friends and visitors used to stress me out. There were too many sites to check on the secondary market. Am I getting a good deal? Am I getting the best deal I can get? What if there's a better seat and I just forgot? Well, guess what? SeatGeek has solved all of those problems for you. It pulls millions of tickets into one place. Only have to visit SeatGeek and that's it. And you can easily find the best seat you want for the price you're willing to pay. They have a super easy to use color-coded system. Green dots for good deals, red dots for less good deals. It's very interactive and easy to see where your seat is, whether it's obstructed, unobstructed, all of that. And best of all, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. SeatGeek should be your go-to ticket source for everything, sports, concerts, Broadway shows, theater, comedy, all of it. Best of all, my listeners get $10 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app. Enter promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. That's promo code LOW. Bam, $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, life's an event, and we have the tickets.
Have you talked to Markelle Fultz since you guys traded him?
Not. I hit him with a text and wished him well. But in relation to, you know, talking to him after that, I have not.
Have you come, we're a month, he's now a member of the Orlando Magic. It's been a month since that is a thing. I don't want to go through the history of the transaction and all of that. It's obviously a big moment for the Sixers that didn't go as planned. Have you come to any, with a month distance, any finality to what happened?
Right. I mean, we all have ideas of how it all happened, you know, the draft, the injury situations in between. To speculate deeply, I'm not going to do. To say this completely, sincerely, I will do. He physically, just his basketball body, is as gifted and well built as you could wish for in the design of a point guard. You know, long arms, big feet, high hips, you know, an intellect that thinks the game, all over the place, like elite, really elite. And so I hope he can take those gifts and truly find success. I believe he's going to come good. You know, I think that with time and maybe less scrutiny and expectation because he's a good kid, and I do think that he cares. And, you know, his situation obviously has been well documented. But in the light of day and in the rearview mirror, to your point, hindsight for me says that those comments I can speak about freely.
Do you, I mean, I have to ask you, but I'll just ask it baldly. Do you believe that he was physically injured?
I do. I think that there was a connection to him, you know, with sort of the mental side of it all. I think that he was, something was up. Something was up. And I think like his injury, you know, expedited maybe uncertainty about how does this whole thing play out? How does it shake out? And so to point at any other area, I don't think is fair. I don't think it's fair and I don't believe it. And so I stand by what I said, and I think it's, you know, is it the chicken or the egg or the chicken, whatever I'm saying, the injury started this whole thing, and it ended up where it ended up.
One of my flashbulb memories from last year's playoffs will always be the moment in game three, maybe, against Boston, where you took Joel off of Horford and put him onto Marcus Morris. I've been thinking about that ever since it happened. Not that it's unprecedented. You know, you understand why you did it.
But you're talking about in the game or timeouts or which
play? There were extended stretches when it was like his primary assignment was no longer the opposing center. It was Marcus Morris over here on the wing.
Yep.
I understand why you did it, but Joel isn't, Joel isn't a plotting center. Yeah. Who is considered a liability that, you know, the minute you face a shooting five like Al Horford, you're like, oh my God, we got to do something about it. Joel's a defensive player of the year candidate. It was jarring to see a coach. And again, you're not the only one that's done this. I mean, Gobert has problems in the playoffs too. It was jarring to see a coach take a player of that caliber and say, this assignment, maybe you weren't saying this. To me, what you were saying was, you can't do this well enough. It's hurting our team. We're going to put you over here. And now maybe you can help our team over here because Marcus Morris isn't a great shooter. He doesn't have the ball a lot. You might be able to hang near the paint. But I've been thinking about that a lot. What did that mean? Like, what did that mean to you? And what does it say about Joel's pick and roll defense and what the playoff life is going to be if you get a matchup like that?
And so where do you begin with this question? Because this is coach speak deep.
Go deep.
And let me sort of start with this. When we had a math sort of feel to this analytically, like how does it look analytically? C minus. Gut feel, how does it feel,
Joel? C minus for what?
Effectiveness, Joel guarding pick and pop five men.
Okay.
Yeah, and we had the body of work, you know, for a year. And then you take an elite player like Al Horford is, and it's just punishing and to a point influencing, but the numbers bear out horribly, you know, by playoff standards. And so you have that sort of sitting on your shoulder. Then you have like a gut feel. Am I putting Joe in the best place that I can place him to impact the game? And I feel that it produced a study for us over the summertime of how do we keep Joel Embiid on the floor and maybe do a better job of guarding Horford if that's what the matchup requires. I'll be in the same situation this year, you know, with Boban, to an extreme sort of sense. And lots of other good coaches before me, Pop included, and Doc and Stan, you know, like really did not find a way to do that. And maybe I might not too, but I hope to. And so you comment about you take Joe off Horford, you know, kind of why. It was driven out of a bunch of reasons that we tried to get him out of pick and rolls as much as possible. And if he were going to be in pick and rolls, it wasn't going to be with Al, because it doesn't, just because you change the matchup, obviously coaches hunt things out.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was driven for some of those reasons.
Did he take it well?
I thought he was okay. You know, some of the audience will be listening like, oh, you know, Al's going to pick and pop and, and shoot a three. And that's why there was equal at times punishment on the catch, go, go, catch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Al was great at that.
He is.
Catch, and pump, so, drive by.
That's
him.
Right. Yeah. And so it wasn't just, you know, I don't remember the number percentage wise that he was at. I want to say 40.
For the season last year?
Yeah, last year.
It was like high 30s. It was good. Whatever.
Really
was
good. And so, like, you know, you don't want somebody like that. So Joe would run out and try to ball and bam, you know, he'd catch and pull it. And so I felt like, it wasn't so much an indictment on Joe. It's like I didn't feel like I was helping Joel. I didn't feel like we were putting him in the best position to stay on the floor and help the team and play extended minutes and stay out of foul trouble and all of that. But it's not going to go away. And here, you know, we'll be back there with somebody. It could be Lopez or, you know, pick him. And I hope, like, the body of work that we've studied over the summer and the schematic changes we've made defensively will enable us to be better equipped when that situation happens.
So you mentioned Boban. Credit to you for being the first coach to, I think, fully realize that Boban is the best player in the NBA and should have a role on any team that he wants and any team that he's on. But you bring up Boban and defending stretch fives. And I was at this Philly-Cleveland game the other night where you guys, you know, you won't say this. I'll say you guys bothered to try for 3 minutes of that game, and that was enough to win. Cleveland tried very hard. But Larry Drew came in with a plan, and his plan was when Boban comes on, Channing Frye comes on for the exact reason we're talking about. And your response to it was, we don't care. Yeah. What appeared to be, we don't care. And Channing Frye got like 7 open threes or whatever it was, missed all of them. And it was fascinating to me to watch because it's been on my mind all year. Like 3 days before that, the Pacers played the Bucks, and there's been a lot of now talk about how the Bucks are allowing a ton of threes, but they seem to be allowing the right kinds of threes.
That's right.
And whether you believe that or not, that's their goal, right? And something is working. So they played the Pacers. Without checking, Miles Turner must have taken 9 threes in the first half, all wide open. Brooke Lopez dropped. Miles Turner's shooting 40% from three. The math on that is bad. The math on Channing Frye, even old man retiring Channing Frye, taking open threes is bad. But it was really interesting to watch Miles Turner on like three-pointer number 4. You could see him think, have I shot too many?
Right.
Is it someone else's turn now? Like, what if I miss again? And I really believe that something about how the Bucks have played and other teams that are playing like this is playing into that mental aspect. Like, that's not a random thing. That's a thing they're factoring in. Like, that guy doesn't want to shoot 9 in a row. It's a rare kind of bird who wants to shoot right. 9 in a row. So were you cool with Channing Frye just letting it fly?
We were. And the tolerance, because you're always, and it heats up. Like, you're always asking yourself, what sword are you prepared to fall on? What sword are you prepared to die on? And it gets to be a very significant question when the stakes are higher in the playoffs. When you play in Cleveland in March 13th or whatever day it was, knowing that it was Boban's first game back, I want to see what we have. I want to feel my own personal tolerance level factored into that, and it will going forward. And as I've admitted to Philadelphia media, that I think, like, that's my job to figure out, what do we have? You know, how do I take what we have and make it work? There will be maybe some painful decisions that, you know, in hindsight don't help us, that I feel like I have to make before the playoffs begin. And I'm going to do it. And the case that you're talking about is one of them.
Just let's see what happens.
You have to. Like, what do we have in Boban? Because there's two things that
you can't ask Boban to blitz. That's not an option.
And, you know, I think two things stand out. First, there is zero doubt, supported by incredible evidence, how effective he is at the rim if he can stay in the game. So if it's a static game and they put Channing Frye in a bunch of pick and rolls and they pick and pop him, or he trails in and that's all they do, well, you know, you got some decisions. But in the pace of the game, maybe Boban's blocking somebody on a drive or a kick ahead or whatever, he still can be positioned at a rim where he can be effective. Offensively, he's still 7'4", and Channing Frye has to defend him. Yeah. And so there is, you know, decisions to be made. And right now in the middle of March, I'm prepared to take some hits and experience some pain so that we can assess our tolerance level when it matters most.
That Miles Turner game really encapsulated what the Bucks are doing to me, because it not just because he missed a lot of threes, but because you could see his mind begin to work. And when your mind begins to work, the offense is not going to, is not going to work. And to your point, and I'm not, clearly there are players you cannot do this against. Okay. It's not, but, you're not getting free throws. You're not getting offensive rebounds and you're not getting to the rim. And if you go through a stretch of a game where that guy is 1 of 8, like the math doesn't just work. The math just, you just won the math by a mile. It's really interesting.
You know, just finally to your point, when over my, I think it's 19 years, over my years in the league, you see pick and roll defense has changed. It went to a heavy dose about 6, 5 years ago, 7 years ago into pushing stuff down a sideline. You know, there was a stage where you'd just chase over under, the big would drop. People called it drop, center field, whatever. And then, like, that whole sort of pushing, keeping things on a sideline evolved. And then here comes the step-ups, and here comes, like, offensively the snake backs or the crossbacks. You could just see the offense react to the defense and so on. But there was a tolerance level when you pushed a sideline pick and roll that, you know, say Joel's back and say Ben's pushing it, and LaMarcus Aldridge just goes sort of unimpeded to an elbow and just starts burying, you know, like elbowed 18-foot jump shots after 18-foot jump shots. Historically in my Spurs life, we'd always go and say, you know, what are we prepared to live with? And by and large, you could stick with that for the most part. When you couldn't and where you couldn't was when the players just got so, like, disheartened, or there were stages of the game where you had to do something. Like, the players didn't believe. It just repetitively happened, and you felt as a coach, you better change this. Like, the spirit of the team, you can just feel.
That's so fascinating, because I was talking about someone to this, about this with someone the other day. Like, the battle between math and humans is, comes right there. When you have a game plan that the math says is a good game plan, and for 4 possessions in a row, you lose the math, but the math still says, well, we don't change. Like, 10 more possessions, we're going to win. But you see the players begin to look at you, look at each other, get frustrated. And, like, I don't think they care about the math in that moment.
That's when you take, in my opinion, like a really big hammer and smash your calculator. It doesn't win games. It doesn't. You know, like, the players are the pulse of what's really going on. And I think it's important for the coach, and you say this in scouting reports or halftime, whatever, do not overreact, right? There's a stage where I got you, like, maybe we do have to change, but do not get tricked quickly. Don't overreact. And it gets back to, like, I think also at times the comfort of a player. This is the deal. This is the game plan, and this is the reason why. And then at some point, you might have to pivot out of it when it's just repetitive, and people don't want to see repetitive buckets defensively, competitively. That doesn't keep a team
together.
That's
exactly what it is, to get beat by the same thing over and over again. Even if you know in your heart that same thing's not going to beat us much longer, it really tests, it tests a lot of fascinating human dynamics. Anyway, I don't want to belabor that. I just thought it was interesting. Listeners, hiring, I can imagine, is one of those things that can be challenging and time-consuming. There are hundreds of job boards. Do you have to post your ad on every one? How do you know that you're not missing the one job board that has the right person? But there's one place where you can go that makes it simple, fast, and smart, and that place is ZipRecruiter.com/LowPost, the name of this podcast. ZipRecruiter sends your job automatically to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, and they don't even stop there. They have powerful matching technology that scans thousands of resumes and proactively finds people with the right experience, and then double proactively invites them to apply to your job. You've done nothing except use ZipRecruiter. Bam, they've found people for you. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers, that's a lot. If you shoot 80% from the foul line, that's pretty good. 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. You pretty much can't do any better than that. Right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free, zero, nothing, at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/LowPost. The name of this podcast, LOWEPOST, that's ZipRecruiter.com/LowPost. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. You mentioned before you were the fake GM for 3 months. That was your wording, not mine.
You can keep it.
Weren't you the president of basketball operations for, did you ever get the title? Did you have business cards printed with the title?
No,
I would have.
I still don't have a head coach business card. No and no.
I think I was.
But I candidly, you know, talk with owners that have treated me incredibly. I mean, Josh Harris and David Blitzer are friends and have treated me very fairly over my time here. And we've grown a lot together. We've developed a lot here together. The situation was with Brian was, you know, a very unfortunate, sad situation. And here I am. And so, you know, you try to just help. You just try to do whatever you could to hold us together. And so for 3 months, I did that as best I could. You know, went through the draft, went through the whole, and had tremendous resources. To think like it was me is just not true or fair. I had firepower all behind me. And Elton's got the same firepower now. Yeah. And, you know, to end up, to blink and sort of end up with Elton Brand, who I coached and was in my locker room and experienced, you know, good and bad with me, and now see him two offices down as my general manager. I love him. I think he's a star in the making. He's a tremendous person. That's a fine, Zach. That is you. That's a fine right there.
That's a professional no-no,
actually. That is Zach's phone interrupting his own interview.
That's the first time that's ever happened, okay. Actually.
I think how many former players, I mean, what's he earned? $150 million? Like, how much money has he earned over his time? Have the fortitude, the desire, the commitment to get in at 7 in the morning, put on a shirt and tie, show up at work, leave late, deal with, you know, an agent or a disgruntled player or something that's going on with marketing where we don't want this promotion as the playoffs happen, you know, happy birthday, Ben, talk to Joe. Like he's incredible to me because he's seen it all as a player. He's not poor, yet he chooses this job in a really kind of delicate time to want to put his hand up and help. And I think he's a star.
Then he does things that are risky and splashy and stuff you didn't have to do to be a competitive team. I mean, you had a competitive team, but none of this was the reason why I brought this up. The reason why I brought this up was now I want to know when your 3 month reign of terror is over. I want to know. So Tobias Harris, I think, is 2 days before the trade deadline. It was marinating a little bit before that, or maybe it was a day before. I can't remember. At what point are you in on that? Like, is it already well down the road at this point, or are you so ensconced in the leadership here where you're in at the very beginning? Like, hey, how about we ask about that guy?
Elton would always share things that he felt I needed to know, and he would avoid things that just weren't real. They were just chatter, and way sooner than before it actually happened, there was discussion, you know, about Boban, Tobias. You know, there was tom-toms in the marketplace about other things as well, obviously. But the drumbeat got louder as the deadline got closer, and I was sequestered into a room after one of our games and said, this is now real. It's on the table. And around me was Josh Harris and David Blitzer and Elton Brand and Alex Rucker and Scott O'Neill and myself. And, you know, we went through the thumbs up, thumbs down stuff. Just like we ended up all having to do with Dario and Cove. And, you know, I'll remember that night for a long time. And to your point, you know, it was a gutsy move by our owners allowing Elton to do it, a gutsy move by Elton, you know, pushing it to do it. And I think the people behind the scenes, Alex Rucker and Ned Cohen and Mark Eversley, he's got really good people around him. It's probably the thing I'm most proud of during my 3 month reign of whatever you called it, was we were able to keep people in the boat. Like, yeah, we really, amongst the turmoil, you know, could keep the coaching staff, the large portion of the front office, the medical staff. We had almost 45 contracts done. Think of that.
Yeah.
And I think that we have A people and A competence, and Josh and the owners were fantastic on allowing us to secure people's future, you know, and continue to move the program forward.
What game was that?
I don't remember the game. I remember the event. I don't remember.
Was it here or was it on the road?
It was here.
Yeah. I'm just curious. I just thought the timing of these are always interesting. Yeah, was it like a week before? Or was it like hours before we learned about
it? I would say more hours than I think a day, 24 hours.
And so without naming names, were there any thumbs down? Or do you not go until there's all thumbs up or at least all thumbs up and maybe like, eh?
I mean, at the end of the day, Josh and Blitz rule the day.
Sure, you know? I know who's making the final call.
Right.
Was there one guy in the room saying no?
Thumb up, thumb up. I mean, okay. It comes with tremendous, you know, thought and research and, you know, the assets you give up, we've all worked hard to accumulate over our years. And so it's not discussed lightly. There's tremendous thought. But at the end of the day, it was a unanimous thumbs up.
You've mentioned Brian Colangelo a few times. That makes me think that you still have the same kind of relationship or level of affection for him that you did before, whatever that level was. Have you talked to him lately?
I texted him after it happened, and I have not. He went on his way and now trying to rebuild his own career and move forward. I do appreciate the time that he came in here and spent with us. You know, I had a long talks with Jerry, his dad, about everything. And, you know, Jerry, because of USA Basketball and him being such a fan of Pop, he and I connected quite quickly. But in the meantime, you know, I look back at that situation with Brian and wish him well. He certainly has tremendous value. He's good and smart at what he does. And just to see how it played out here in Philadelphia was an incredibly unfortunate situation.
Is the first you hear of that, the when the Ringer emails and said, hey, we have this, and then it just filters through the organization like, uh-oh?
I think so. I don't really remember when I first heard of it. As I remember, you know, it coming out into the marketplace, I think our guys were doing some pre-draft stuff at one of the workouts. But, so much stuff comes out, you don't know what's accurate and what isn't accurate. But I do remember, you know, when it was printed and became public, that your first reaction was, you know, is it true? Then you started thinking about your players and thinking about Brian and his family. He's got a great family. You know, Mattia, his son, is plays for the University of Chicago. He's got a daughter going to Villanova, and, you know, they're a good family, and so you just hope everything has settled in okay for them.
It was obviously a crazy and sad story. Playoffs are coming up soon. I think There are Sixers fans who say, we think Brett's good. We don't quite know what we have in him yet because his first X years here were just awash in terms of the on-court result, not really mattering. Last year, I think, was the first year you came under some scrutiny in a playoff series against Boston when Brad Stevens, what a great job bad Brad did, blah, blah. Is Brett going to respond? Is he up to this? And now, of course, Brad has come under scrutiny this year for the first time. It's funny how the way that works. But do you as a coach feel pressure to the owners have come out and said, we got big expectations here. I mean, do you feel the pressure for yourself personally?
I feel this isn't offered with anything else but sort of a direct answer to your question. I feel a responsibility and I feel an opportunity. I think the pressure word for me quickly is displaced by those two words. I'm not young anymore. I'm not, and like you see the world differently. And my focus is on trying to take what we have and just do the best you can to win, you know, and get it into the playoffs and win in the playoffs. And the city of Philadelphia, it's a rough city for sure. But I actually, in a very sadistic way, I like the fight. You know, I like the blue collar side of stuff. I'm in the city all summer with my son at AAU events and playgrounds and gyms that nobody has heard of. And stuff that interests me. There's a part of Philadelphia that interests me. And so this thing will play out as it will play out. And I sleep at night just fine. And, you know, excited for the opportunity slash responsibility.
How is your sleep? How is your mental health? Now there's all this mental health talk about players and the play. And no, but I'm being serious about how I think Adam and Kevin Love and DeMar DeRozan have all done a good job spotlighting the sort of dangers of social media and anxiety issues and sleep and all of that. We don't hear about it with coaches as much. Do you sleep enough?
I don't probably sleep as much as I should. Some of it is because there's stuff on your mind.
Of course.
Yeah. You know, and it could be anything from anything and so on. But I think what never is on my mind is, you better get this right or life isn't as good as it used to be. That's never how I think. That's never how I think. It's always about how do you, you know, really help the players. How do you help them? How do you help your staff? And that sort of, that mentality has served me well since I have been here. Only, you know, however many months ago, there was great scrutiny and recommendation to me. Like, you can't come out last year in the preseason and say our goal is to make the playoffs. Now think about that. And I felt like a coward if I didn't say, you serious? Like, my goal is to make the playoffs. And then all of a sudden we started winning, and then we got Irsan and Marco. Then we won 16 games in a row. And, you know, now we want the third seed, and now we're going to play in the Eastern Conference Championship, and we lose to Boston. And, you know, it's a big, for me too, a negative. And was the season successful? And you're reminded of how fast this thing has changed. It really has moved quick. And so now this year, you know, we do the trades, we get the players, and the expectations are fair. You know, in many ways, the talent would suggest that we can be amongst the Eastern Conference big boys, the elite. And so do we have time? Well, we'll find out, won't we? But I feel like, to your point about, you know, sleeping and, you know, mental health, I'm great. I love my job. I love coming into this office. I love seeing the players. And I'm very grateful that I have the people, the staff, Elton, around me to help me, because we all need a little bit of help.
Well, dating to the Hinkie regime in your early days here, you guys were toward the top of the curve or ahead of the curve in the monitoring the biological stuff. How much water are people drinking? Yeah. You know, what's the workload going to be? Blah, blah. Do you feel that you've done as much with player mental health as you've done with physical health? Is there more to do? What have you done that you think has been helpful for them?
Well, first we've hired a performance coach full time, travels with me, really has an incredible, history and resume and dealing with professional athletes. So that's kind of first and foremost. We've always been proactive, and I think at the forefront of lots of things, to your point, of the holistic sort of meaning nowadays of sports science. And, you know, the player development, phrasing, the stuff that really falls underneath player development is massive. I believe that, and it's happening now. I think we're going to see it happen in more significant ways. You're going to have like a Team Joel, you know, and Team Joel is going to have, you know, a doctor or two, a sports scientist, a physiotherapist, maybe a nutritionist, you know, a dedicated on-court skill coach, you know, financial advisors, people to help them with presentation in the media or public speaking. Like, think about player development phrasing.
Yeah.
And then you say, well, here's, you know, somebody that's worth, you know, a couple hundred million, and how are we going to, like, preserve their image and help them?
How's this Shirley Temple intake? Is it down?
I think it's down.
Okay.
I think it's down. And to your question 5 minutes ago about, you know, mental health, it just falls under such a wide range of player development issues, and we feel really positive and confident that we have addressed that.
The Spurs were one of the teams, like, there weren't there no phones rules at dinner? It's that maybe for some of the Spurs players, I feel like the no phones thing was a Spurs thing. A Spurs dinner thing.
I think that's true. I should know that more quickly. I know here in my first years when we did the team dinners, and we continue to do them, Evan Turner's idea was to, you know, take all the phones and put them in a big jar in the middle and, like, have a sort of a few-hour moratorium. Like, you just couldn't touch stuff. And how it works nowadays around the league, I don't know. But trying to do team stuff and phones, you know, I got a 14-year-old son. It's quite shocking the volume of man hours that is spent on phones nowadays.
He's a baller, too.
He loves it. He loves
it. Little point guard, right?
Yeah, trying to get him to be a Philly point guard, and it's a tough city, and, you know, to see the talent come out from this city and the spirit and the toughness is, I'm grateful that I can raise him here in Philadelphia.
Speaking of dinners and Spurs, I have to ask you a couple rapid-fire Spurs things before we get the Spurs. It's just the Spurs stuff is too good. I'm guessing you cannot free up to go to Manu's jersey retirement ceremony, can you?
I don't believe so. I've played tag with Pop on this and RC, but I don't believe so. And I got to look deeper into this. My life moves as quickly as theirs do, but I don't believe so. Which hurts me.
I'm going to try to go. It's going to be a good one. I mean, you and I have talked about Manu before. There's only one Manu. What are your memories that this almost mythic dinner that it's become mythic almost in NBA history at Il Gabbiano, the night after the Spurs lose the Ray Allen game six, the most heartbreaking loss I think a team has had. I mean, I'd have to go back and dive in maybe since I've been covering the league, which is 10 years. You go to dinner. Pop is like, we're going to dinner. Everyone's coming. I believe they're like, let's bring family members, whatever is going to be necessary to get us through this night. And we're going to sit and we're going to be with each other and we're going to eat just like we always do. And when I wrote a big story about Manu, I talked about that dinner, and it was him and Splitter and Mills and I think Diaw at one table. And Tiago told me it was the only dinner no one talked. We did not say one word to each other. We just scraped our food around. What do you remember about that dinner? Who are you sitting with? Who are you talking to? What's it like?
I remember a few things. First, I remember that the marching orders that came from Pop were swift and deliberate. And this is what we're going to do. We are going to try to find a way to rebuild, regroup, and we're going to do that like he loves doing at a dinner. And we're going to this restaurant. The team will be there, wives, girlfriends, moms, dads, traveling party. You know, you can imagine the entourage that goes to the finals. And so everybody is not welcome. Everybody will be there. Like, those are the marching orders. And there we were. So I remember that first. I remember sitting with Pop, next to Pop, with our coaches, and watching him, you know, walk from sort of table to table to table, talking to the families and the players, and trying to do whatever he could to reclaim the spirit. You know, remind them that there's more to do. And, you know, none of this should surprise any of the listeners or you. You know, like, we all get Pop's gifts and strength, and this is so up his alley. And just another, maybe the most defined reminder of stuff like this that he is so gifted at.
Who else did you talk to?
Oh, I hit all the players, too. I would walk around for sure and touch the players. You know, you just wanted to, and if it was nothing more than a fist bump or, you know, a sentence, you know, maybe 10 minutes, I walked around and also tried to, you know, do something with every single player. Like, you just go way out of your way to make sure you did your part in trying to help us get back on track.
Where'd you watch the clinching game the next season when they avenged the Miami loss and win what ends up being the last title of the Duncan era?
I'm in a hotel room, in Philadelphia, and I'm looking at it thinking that where we were and the level of disappointment to rebuild that and play the style that they were playing at that stage, because their style has changed. I give Pop credit. It's sort of like a evolution, chameleon, take your talent, make it work type stuff. They played a style that I don't think the league has seen for a while now. The thing, I mean, I call it popcorn. It influenced me, you know, like we try to do it as much as we can with Tiago and Boris and everybody. They're all passing and sharing and moving and cutting. And really, as I remember it, I think they could have swept the series. Like really, you know, I don't remember what it ended up. The series
4-1.
4-1, yeah. You know, it could have been a sweep. And to remember like how that season was lost, because I still remember Mono going to the line. We're up 5 with, 26 seconds left. And I couldn't even look at Pop. I'm like, we're going to win. We're going to beat LeBron, Dwayne, and Bosch. We're going to win another championship. And I get goosebumps even sharing that again with you. I think we've already talked about this. And it doesn't get old. And, you know, he splits, three ball, the whole thing. We get how it ended up. To think like they the summer would have stunk. To have that end your basketball season, that's when it does stink. That's when it's rough to sleep. You know, I don't care what anybody says. That would have been a terrible summer. It was for me, and I wasn't even coaching the team. I had a new job, or really, you know, learned in August that I had a new job with Philadelphia. And so to see what they did, him as a coach, them as an organization, for sure Mono and all the players, Timmy and Tony and all that, that's as spectacular a mental toughness turnaround and a statement that they made as I can think of.
Do you FaceTime yourself into the locker room celebration or anything? I feel like, you know, that was your first year away after so many years with the Spurs. You know everybody there. I feel like Someone should FaceTime you so you can watch the champagne.
You know, I don't remember if it was FaceTime. There was definitely communication and certainly texts. And, you know, from afar, you let it play out, and then you sort of come after a few days. But, you know, to your point, it was an incredible statement, a statement of strength, fortitude, perseverance. Use words, whatever you want. Like, they didn't go away. They didn't cry about it. They didn't roll over. They got it out of their way over the summertime and then just jumped back into this thing in an incredible way and ended in the most glorious of fashions.
It is interesting to think about Spurs lose in the first round of 2009. Manu's hurt. You lose to Dallas. 2010, you get swept by the Suns.
How about that?
2011, you lose the 1-8 series to Memphis. Manu's hurt again.
Yeah.
And those three in a row, the end of that, that was the first time people thought, maybe it's over.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it for the Spurs. Then the next year is the lockout year. I believe you get the 1 seed, lose to Oklahoma City. But that year was, okay, it's not it for the Spurs. You won 20 games in a row, I think, that year. And then Kawhi changes everything, 13-14, it goes on and on. After that 11 series against Memphis, which is Shane Battier hitting threes, all this, did you maybe think it was over? Did people within the team worry that maybe the run's out?
I mean, if the version of over equals you don't have what it takes to win a championship.
Yeah, maybe we're just a run-of-the-mill good team.
I didn't really feel that. I really didn't feel that. You know, I was so spoiled. 3 out of my first 4 years, you come in like you're winning championships. Think about that.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good. And, you know, you think, well, this is wonderful. You got Duncan and Robinson, and Timmy retires, and you're still doing it. And I think, like, we were also confident, I think, in the system, in the program, and in Pop, and Timmy and Tony Mono, that NRC was amazing, like putting pieces around it. I would be not telling the truth if I felt like, oh, it's over. I didn't. Like, it still shocks me that they're as good as they are even now. It's quite an incredible sporting longevity that they have lived.
Yeah, I picked them to miss the playoffs, and I will be wrong about that. And many people warned me, don't do that. They're the Spurs. And that's, you know, then DeJounte got hurt and I was like, oh, now I feel very confident. And of course I'm wrong. Someone told me to ask you this. Someone from the Spurs, extended Spurs family said, ask Brett about, alleged wrestling matches with Don Newman that happened after a Pop coaches meeting. What in the hell is that about? The late Don Newman.
Yeah.
The wrestling?
The late Don Newman was a good man. He really, an interesting story. I mean, he played in the CFL. He played in the CBA for George Karl, the old CBA. So he's a professional football player for the Canadian Football League. I remember somebody dug in and and played for a second with the Jets. I mean, somebody dug in that deep and showed him returning a punt return in a preseason game. That the fan, you know, Pop was masterful at going back into the archives and finding video of either me in high school or Don Newman returning a punt, you know, against.
You played for your dad in high school, right?
I did. Yeah. I played for my dad and then Coach Pitino. But to your point, so New was like an athlete and a fullback and, you know, Louisiana hard. He was just strong. And there would often be wrestling matches, you know, that would just be out of fun, some out of frustration. Sometimes you'd have, you know, maybe too long of a dinner and, it would be fun, but he was against the players? No, I would need help. Sometimes it would be against a player. Sometimes it would be against a few people on the staff. You know, sometimes.
Pop never got involved in this, did he?
As I remember it, no, but it wouldn't have surprised me. Some at 2 a.m, you know, so.
Pop is gonna throw in some Ric Flair dirty tricks if he ever gets involved in like some eye gouges. He's not gonna be above that. What player?
Oh, I think I don't really remember all of it. I mean, I was with him, I think, for 7 years, 6 years, and it was just in good fun. It would happen very, very rarely, but I'd be lying if I told you it never happened.
I want like Matt Bonner to jump in. For some reason, I'm thinking of Matt Bonner. I don't know why.
How about Monique Batia?
Last question, and I'll let you go because we're in Philadelphia. I have to ask you this. You've had such a unique tenure here. If you actually go through all the names of the players who were part of the process, it's so many players.
120. I think it's 120 or 30.
Like I was a high school teacher for 2 years. 2 years, that's it. I can't remember all the students I had. Like, they could line up out there, I'd remember half their names. 2 years. Is there a player, like a forgotten process player that you are especially fond of, or remain in touch with, or you're like, man, I got to get back in touch with them. I'm so curious to know what Hollis Thompson is up to right now. Is there a guy like that that is still like near and dear to you that Philly fans, it's like 17 iterations of the team ago, they've just totally forgotten about him?
To sort of like declare one person, no. What I would tell you is, like, I stay in touch, you know, once a year, twice a year. A random text, hey, how are you, with the very large majority of my players. I am shocked. Like, every time we go out to do the national anthem now in season 6, you know, where you're across the line and you're looking down, to be able to, like, see either a coach or a player that used to be here interest me. You know, I'm proud of that.
Yeah. AI was here. I saw him walk out. Yeah, he was here today.
Like, I mean, how cool is that? I had a film session today. We're going through situation defense, you know, when we trap, when we wouldn't. And Alan's in the building. I bring him over. I sit him down with the team and, you know, have a chance to talk and share some stories with him and him with me. And you look behind me and you see all these banners of Philadelphia royalty with Wilt and Julius and so on and AI and Charles, and it's quite special. But to your question, we've had a lot of people come through here. I think the number's 140, 130 maybe. I think it's 27 point guards.
My God.
Yeah. No, there's real numbers.
That's amazing.
There's real numbers out there. And
that can't be true.
Yeah.
You know what? It can be true.
I mean, one of my point guards, Tim Frazier, came in and, you know, I shook his hand and started him and, you know, ran a middle pick and roll for maybe the whole game.
I literally have no memory of Tim Frazier playing for the 76ers.
Yeah.
He's played for a million teams, but I don't remember that happening.
There are a lot of players that aren't in the NBA anymore.
Oh.
In fact, the very large majority are not in the NBA
anymore. You said Tony Roten, like, I remember Tony Roten, of course, you know, but Tim Frazier, I've got no memory of playing for Philadelphia.
You know, people like Hollis, who's playing over in Greece, and, you know, Henry Sims was always one of my favorites.
There's another one, Georgetown, right?
Henry Sims, and good people, like, you know, just
he looked like a big guy who could shoot. Like, why couldn't he stick in the league? I don't know where the hell he is.
I think he's in business. I think he took his Georgetown education and, you know, made some money and now jumped into real life. But, no, he was good people and he could shoot and he certainly was tough.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the speed of the game got the better of him, but
MCW's out of the league.
In rookie of the year. I mean, think about that. Like, I suspect there aren't many NBA rookies of the year who, you know, are out of the league. He'll be back. I think that he will be back. I think he's good enough, big enough, you know, has a position. Hopefully he can just keep working on his shot.
Well, the point is, Coach, it's been a long journey, but here we are. The playoffs are almost here. You got a killer starting five, and the Eastern Conference is shaping up to be a lot of fun. Maybe not as fun for you as it is for just the neutral parties like me, but I'm glad you've, as we've said before, not a lot of coaches stick through the 27 point guards to get to the team that can make the finals. So I'm glad for you and your family that you have. I wish you luck, and thanks for taking a little time for us.
Zach, thanks. It's always always fun talking.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.